This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Ruth Reichel, knows a lot about food, how to prepare it, how to savor it, and how to write about it. She's the former restaurant critic for the New York Times and the LA Times, and she's the author of two best-selling memoirs that revolve around food. Since 1999, she's been editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine, and now she's edited a cookbook collecting over 1,000 recipes selected from the 60,000 recipes that Gourmet has published in its over 60-year history. The recipes aren't meant to be food nostalgia. They were tested and, when necessary, updated for the new book. Reichel learned to cook from an earlier edition of the Gourmet Cookbook. Putting together this new edition immersed her in food history and also brought many memories to the surface. Ruth, welcome back to Fresh Air. At the beginning of the Gourmet Cookbook, you write, "Reading Gourmet was the doorway to a magic land where sophisticated men sipped drinks with names like Angel's Dream, brandy top with cream, while beautiful women nibbled on truffled chicken." What are some of the other magical recipes that you remember from the early years that you were reading Gourmet?
Well, among other things, the early Gourmet had recipes for things like muskrat and raccoon.
You're kidding, really?
No, I'm not. I mean, there would be recipes that said, you know, catch one otter, or really odd game foods.
I guess that says something about the diversity of the readership.
Absolutely. I mean, people were hunters in those days, and wild boar. And then there were exotic things with Hawaiian names like Nua Moi, which turned out to require coconuts. And really, you know, to me, a little girl in New York, incredibly exotic things.
It seems some foods just expire over the years the way, you know, or like they're out of print. Nobody uses them anymore. I remember when I was growing up, one of my father's favorite dishes at the better restaurants was lobster thermidor.
Actually, we do have a lobster Newberg in this book, which is a surprising recipe because it's, one, not very complicated, and two, incredibly delicious. It ran in the 1940s as lobster thermidor, but it was incorrect. And one of the things when we were working on the book, we actually started researching the history of these dishes. And Newberg is made with cream, egg yolks, and sherry. And thermidor is actually a flour-thickened bechamel sauce. Huh. And what we have in the book is a lobster Newberg. And it is really delicious and really not complicated.
But wouldn't you say you never see either lobster thermidor or lobster Newberg on menus anymore? That it's a food it's a recipe that's kind of expired?
I would say that, yes.
And how do foods go in and out of fashion like that? Can you explain it?
Well, I think one reason why this dish went out of fashion is that lobster used to be very luxurious food, very expensive. And lobster has become much more available to, I mean, you can buy lobsters in the supermarket from a tank. Anybody can. And so it was a hallmark of, you know, a very expensive restaurant in the 40s. And I think it went out of fashion because it was not so complicated or expensive, or, you know, it no longer denoted the most sophisticated thing you could get. And so restaurants moved on to more difficult, more complicated, more expensive foods.
What are some of the other recipes from the past that you think don't really exist in life anymore? people might remember them, but no one makes them, no one eats them anymore.
Well, I mean, we spent a lot of time thinking about that for the book. And, you know, my thought was, I mean, one of those dishes was beef Wellington, which used to be, you know, one of those connotations of a very fancy restaurant. I thought that we needed to have one in the book because I thought, you know, you may only want to make it once in your life, but you're going to be annoyed if you open this book and it's the only book in your kitchen, which I was hoping it would be, and you didn't have a recipe for beef Wellington. And so we argued about it a lot, whether it would go in or not, and we did an updated beef Wellington. We instead of a traditional foie gras and mushroom filling around the filet of beef, we put a cilantro and walnut filling around it and made a very good pastry. And we've made a very good version of beef Wellington. But that's certainly one of those dishes that you just don't see that much anymore.
Now, you point out that Gourmet magazine was born in the meat and potatoes world. What are some of the recipes for vegetables? I mean, what was the vegetable world like in the world of Gourmet in the 40s and 50s? Well, back when a lot of homemakers were basically serving canned vegetables at home.
Well, yeah. I mean, canned vegetables and frozen vegetables came in the 50s and pretty much decimated the vegetable selection in Gourmet's time. We've gone from an agrarian society to a non-agrarian society. And, you know, one of the things that's been really exciting recently is the supermarket is exploding with new vegetables. You know, not only great vegetables that we used to eat. Like, I mean, one of my favorite recipes in the book right now, it's okra season. I mean, people are growing okra and, you know, selling it in farmers markets. And we have this great recipe in the book for roasted okra, which for people who don't like the sort of gelatinous quality of okra, which is, you know, necessary to gumbo, but has a sort of slimy quality. If you roast it in a really hot oven, it's this wonderful sort of candy-like vegetable.
Let's play a game. I'm going to name a decade, and after after each decade, would you tell me a food that was in Gourmet magazine, a recipe that was in Gourmet magazine that is surprising or interesting to you because it's so good, or it's so bad, or it's so hopelessly out of date compared to what people eat today? So we'll start with the 40s.
Okay, my biggest surprise from the 40s was a salad with a butter dressing.
Pure butter? Just butter?
It's melted butter. And
can I say that sounds horrible?
I know.
It
sounded horrible to all of us. And I love butter. I mean, butter is probably the thing that I would least like to do without of all the foods on earth. But the idea of butter lettuce covered with butter dressing sounds really gross to me. It's wonderful. It's just wonderful. And that is truly a surprise.
Wouldn't the cardiologists of the world go on strike if that caught on again?
Probably, but who cares?
Okay, the 50s.
Well, almost the 50s would be shrimp de jong, which is a great shrimp dish that, again, was a real surprise to me, quite simple and very delicious.
What is it?
Shrimp de jong, which takes all of 40 minutes to cook, is basically just shrimp covered with a mixture of butter and breadcrumbs and garlic and sliced almonds and baked. And it's just great.
Okay, the 60s.
Very simple, very clean, uh-huh. Pretty wonderful. The 60s. Well, actually, one of my favorite 60s recipes was a recipe, a very ethnic recipe for kugel, for, Jewish kugel.
Which is like a noodle pudding.
Noodle pudding. And it's very simple and really good. And a recipe I had completely forgotten, very, you know, homey. Mm-hmm. And, one of those things that you taste and you think, oh, why haven't I had this in 30 years? This is great.
You know how popular the blackened fish craze was in the 80s?
Yes.
I don't think it's that popular anymore. I'm wondering, what happened to that? And did you include any, like, blackened fish recipes in the book?
There are no blackened fish recipes in the book. At least, I don't recall us putting any in. And, you know, two things happened with blackened fish. One was there was this incredible explosion of interest in Cajun food in the early 80s. And it was partly we were thrilled to discover there that there was this really gutsy regional American food. I mean, for people who were just falling in love with Italian food and French food, the notion that we had our very own great regional American food that you could be really proud of, that was filled with spice and interest, was really exciting. And blackened redfish was one of those things. And it was just, you know, you threw this fish into a pan, into a really hot pan with lots of searing spices, and it just woke up your taste buds. We fell so much in love with this that we put the poor redfish at on the verge of extinction. It was a red drum, and everybody fell so in love with that dish that suddenly there were no more redfish. And then we started blackening everything else on the face of the earth. But what happened was that Cajun craze made us all suddenly say, well, are there other places in America we should start looking for great food? And because of that, we went off and discovered that the Pacific Northwest had great food. And, you know, there were these great, you know, chicken wings up in Buffalo, and that in St. Louis they were eating toasted ravioli. And it was really a great thing because we went off and discovered the great regional foods of America. And I think it came directly out of this passion for Cajun food.
And yet there's no blackened recipes in your book. Is that because you don't like the taste anymore, or you think it's just a phase, you know, a craze that's totally out of date?
It's also a very hard thing. It's not really home cooking. It was restaurant cooking home.
Right.
And one of the things although this book has our own recipes and recipes from readers and recipes from, you know, all the different countries of the world, and also chef recipes, in general, I'm not a big approver of people trying to cook chef recipes at home. I mean, there's a reason why we go to restaurants, and that's to eat those really complicated dishes. And what we've tried to do are recipes you want to cook at home. And, you know, one thing, if you try and do a lot of blackened food at home, you're going to set off your fire alarms and you're going to be waving plates in front of the smoke. And it's a mess. So why bother?
Now, your new book, your collection of gourmet recipes, is entering a low-carb, no-carb world. I mean, the bookstores are filled with these no-carb, low-carb cookbooks. They're on the bestseller list. So, do you think that tastes or diets have gone completely in that no-carb, low-carb direction? Do you think?
Oh, it'll pass.
Uh-huh.
I mean, we have a history of, you know, first we eat only grapefruits, and then we decide
right.
that eggs are terrible for us, and now eggs are good for us. And you know, first you're only supposed to eat protein, and then you eat it. We go back and forth all the time, and there's always some diet craze that's on the bestseller list. I can't remember a time in my lifetime when there wasn't some diet that everybody was saying, you know, you have to eat this. And they always go away, and they get replaced with something else. But, you know, sensible people still have to eat and cook. And I personally think that a world with no carbohydrates is a pretty sad place.
Now, before going to gourmet, you were a restaurant critic for the New York Times. And one of the things that you were famous for was wearing disguises, using aliases on your credit cards so that people wouldn't know who you were and that you wouldn't be given special treatment and specially prepared food, special tables. And therefore, you could assess what the restaurant was really like, not what it was like when they were trying to please you because you were the restaurant critic for the Times. So how is the dining out experience different for you now? You are still in the food writing business. You're just not reviewing restaurants for the Times. So are you still using any kind of disguises or phony
names? No, the disguises are over. And it's very different now. I mean, I go out and most of the time use my own name, and I sort of figure after 30 years of, you know, being the people's spy, being completely anonymous, always getting the worst table in the room, it's really nice to go out and get a good table, not have to wait for my table. Although I have to say that my husband, who really does not like all the falderol, really prefers it if we just go anonymously. So I would say about half the time we still make them in somebody else, whoever's name we're going with, and just, you know, try and be ordinary people.
When you were using disguises, wigs, I guess phony glasses probably too.
Well, you know, I have a book coming out in April.
What you're going to talk about?
About the disguise. I mean, it's literally each chapter is in the voice of another disguise. I mean, I had real people who I became, and the disguises were very elaborate, and it was an amazing experience to feel what it was like to be an old lady. And my probably most effective disguise was as a sort of very nondescript old woman who was never treated very well. And then I also had I thought she was pretty sexy anyway, blonde woman. And that, for someone who I am not blonde or sexy. And it was amazing to discover my inner blonde with Chloe. And
Chloe,
it was,
perfect.
Yes.
What was the older woman called?
The older woman was Betty Jones.
Oh, Betty Jones,
she was
okay.
And she went out with groups of people, and she was known as Aunt Betty. And everybody referred to her as Aunt Betty. And Aunt Betty had, you know, really... I found her on a bus. I saw a woman. I got up once on a bus to give my seat to an older woman. And she looked at me and she said, "Are you really giving me your seat?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "Oh, no one ever stands up for me. Sometimes I feel invisible." And I thought, that's what I want. I want to be invisible. So I actually followed her home. And her name, you know, looked at her name on her mailbox, and she was Betty Jones. And I turned myself into Betty Jones, and it was an amazing experience.
Where did you go shopping to be her?
I went to thrift stores, and I actually found a pair of Energetic shoes. Do you remember Energetics? They were those sort of lace-up Oxfords with the little holes in them, and I found a pair that fit me perfectly. And I would wear layers and layers of clothes, so I got much larger without having to have pillows on under me. And she really, nobody saw her.
But I'll
tell
you,
nobody saw her.
You can't be, you know, Aunt Betty and go to Le Cirque, because Aunt Betty isn't going to be able to afford Le Cirque. She's unlikely to be there. So you were probably only able to be her in certain restaurants that you were reviewing.
Right, but I could be Aunt Betty in a group of people at Le Cirque, where I could take other people and,
oh, and you'd be
disappear.
There, Aunt Betty. Uh-huh,
I'd be there, Aunt Betty, and I might not be appropriate there, but you get lost in a crowd, and she would just disappear. So we would all be anonymous, and I would get to see what happened. But certainly Aunt Betty alone in a restaurant was pretty conspicuous.
I confess, there are certain things that really bug me about certain restaurants that I see as really pretentious. But I'm wondering, when you were in the guise of Aunt Betty, if there were certain aspects of the more high-end restaurants that seemed particularly snobbish or pretentious to you.
The most difficult experience I had in a restaurant as Aunt Betty was I went by myself once alone to a pretty fancy restaurant as Aunt Betty just for lunch to check on something. I was writing the review, and I suddenly realized that I had only had this dish once, and I thought, to be fair, I needed to have it a second time. So I became Aunt Betty, went there for lunch, and the maitre d' was very nice, but it was the response of these rich women in the restaurant not wanting to sit near me that really offended me. The maitre d' started bringing this bejeweled woman, and she sort of glanced at me and said, I'd like another seat. And I found that deeply offensive. I mean, much more offensive than anything any restaurant ever did.
Did that come up in the review that you wrote?
No, although I did describe this woman with some glee in the review, although not her response to me.
What did you say about her?
I said that she looked like an 18th century portrait and like a pug dog.
Oh, okay. That's the part that hurts.
And I hope she read it and recognized herself.
Do you like coffee shops? And I'm talking about, there's a certain type of New York coffee shop where it's not, like, the coffee's probably really terrible there, but they have, you know, they have your basic, like, omelets and chicken and fish dishes that are prepared, nothing special, but they're really cheap, they're perfectly serviceable, they're fast. I mean, I just love places like that.
And not only that, if you go there a few times, they know you, and you walk in, you sit down at the counter, and they instantly know that what you want is a corn muffin toasted and a cup of coffee with no sugar in it.
Exactly.
And it just, it slides in front. What I love about those places is I love the daily ritual of it. I love that becoming part of a community. I mean, for me, that's one of the things that's so great about restaurants, is that it is a way for you to have a life outside of your ordinary life where you are known, but you're known in just that small corner. And it's very comforting to go in on a regular basis and have that sort of 3 or 4 time a week conversation with someone and to feel like you're recognized. And, you know, I mean, for people like the Betty Joneses of the world who live alone, it's something really wonderful that kind of restaurant, it's a purpose that it serves.
Well, you know, when you were Betty Jones, you would sometimes go alone to a restaurant. I don't know if you do that in your other disguises as well, or if you do that as yourself, as Ruth Reichel. How do you feel about dining alone in a restaurant? Some people are very comfortable doing that. Some people feel incredibly self-conscious. For some people, it makes them feel incredibly lonely, and they think that other people will be staring at them, feeling sorry for them.
Well, I did it. I almost always went to the restaurants that I was reviewing at least once alone, because I like to eavesdrop on people, and it's very hard to do that when you're with a group of people. So I would always go alone just to sort of try and soak up the atmosphere of the restaurant and just to sit there and, you know, focus on what people around me were saying and what they were doing. I have to say that I'm not self-conscious about it, but for me, eating is a social act, and it's not a great pleasure to me to eat alone. You know, I would do it for work, but given my druthers, I would really rather eat bad food in a congenial group of people than great food by myself.
So you're not the kind of person who'll go and prop up your newspaper on the ketchup bottle and enjoy dining out alone.
No, I mean, I, you know, as I said, it's a great way to sort of soak up the atmosphere.
I've done that a lot. But,
no, I'm more likely to go home and eat a bowl of cereal if I'm by myself.
Right.
I mean, I love the social interaction of eating. And for me, you know, the great joy of cooking, of preparing a meal, is that you're gathering people you care about, interesting people, around a table, and you're facilitating the conversation. You know, one of the things that good food does in a relaxed atmosphere is it just makes what happens at a table that much more pleasurable and that much more interesting. And, you know, for me, that's what cooking is about.
You want to tell us about another one of your New York Times reviewer characters?
Sure. Well, my favorite was Brenda. Brenda was a big, boisterous redhead, very messy red hair, long, slightly bohemian, and she made people smile. Everybody smiled at her. And I just felt like Brenda's world was a nicer place than my world. Just everybody talked to her. Waiters loved her, brought her extra food. even in very fancy restaurants. One of my great experiences was going with a group of friends as Brenda and having this quite starchy woman at the next table lean over and say, you know, it looks to me like you don't come to restaurants like this very often. And then getting incredibly embarrassed because she'd realized what she'd said. And Brenda said, no, thank you. That's true. We don't. And she said, well, I just want to make sure you don't miss the great food at this restaurant and be sure that you order this and this and this. And, you know, Brenda was a great pleasure. And, you know, so much so that it scared me a little. My family liked her better than they liked me.
Were you ever in theater?
No, but this was, when I started doing the disguises, my mother had a friend who was a theatrical coach, and she helped me. With the first disguise, she said, you really need to, you need to inhabit this. You can't just put on a wig. That's not going to work. If you're going to do this right. You're the restaurant critic of the New York Times, and you can't be a fool. So she made me, for my first review, which was the review of Le Cirque, she made me really do the whole backstory for the person that I was becoming, who was a very middle-aged Midwestern, very unexceptional woman. But she made me know everything about her. And she came with me to the first meal, and I really did find myself becoming that person. It was a little spooky, but very fun.
Did you have voices for them?
I did. It wasn't conscious. And I can't do them unless I'm them. You know, I mean, it's just now I can't do them. And I'm a little worried because I'm going to have to read the book. And I'm afraid that I'm going to have to get in. And I don't have the disguises anymore, because when I left the Times, we auctioned them off for charity. And I don't have them anymore. And I don't know how I'm going to do the voices.
Ruth, the last time we spoke was when your memoir, Tender at the Bone, was published. And in that, you wrote a little bit about your mother, who you described as being food blind in the way that some people are colorblind. And
right.
That she would, like, serve food that had turned bad and wouldn't be able to tell the difference. And I was trying to remember, was your mother mentally ill? Was this a symptom of a larger problem?
Yeah, she had what's now called bipolar disorder, which in those days was called manic depression. And we didn't know it for a long time. And then in the beginning of the 60s, when the first people who were working with, you know, psychopharmacology, my mother went to see one of those doctors, and for her it was just a huge relief to know that it wasn't her fault. You know, she'd been in analysis, and it was all about, this is your fault. And you know, she said that, you know, being told that there were drugs that you could take for it was just, you know, just a huge, huge relief. In the book, I initially tried to make her a comic character. And when it didn't work, I sort of just came clean and said, you know, she did have this illness.
Were there different foods that she'd make depending on whether she was in a manic or depressive period?
Well, when she was depressed, she just went to bed. She'd go to bed for months on end and literally read the same book over and over and over again. And I mean, one of the reasons, and I didn't put this into the book, but one of the reasons that I started cooking so early was that Mom would just, you know, you'd come home from school and she would not have gotten out of bed all day. And so the cooking really did fall to me. I didn't think that was something that you put in the book, but when she was manic, she was really when she did. I mean, I describe in the beginning of that book, I describe a party she gave for my brother's engagement when she put 26 people in the hospital with food poisoning. And that was at her absolute most manic, when, you know, she went to Horn and Hardart and came home with a car filled with little tiny boxes of food that they had been selling as seconds and mixed it all together in this disgusting mush. And that was, you know, that was about as manic as you can get.
Are there foods that you developed a revulsion to because of something that your mother served, not realizing that it had gone bad or that it just simply tasted terrible?
Oddly, no. You know, what my mother's illness did for me was make me very acutely aware of food, make me very conscious of tasting it to see, is this good or is this not good? Really honed my taste buds. I mean, I think made me really focus on flavor and describing it to myself. I think made me into a food writer. And for whatever reasons, because I'm genetically predisposed to love food and love cooking and love eating or whatever, there's almost nothing that I don't like. And even some of the foods that my mother made most miserable, I still love.
Now, one of the things you did when you were young, you co-founded a cooperative restaurant in Berkeley in the early 70s. And I'm wondering, what are some of the values at that restaurant? You know, what the ethic was at that restaurant, and what seems out of date to you, and what are the values from that restaurant that you still feel are important today?
I have to say, I don't think any of it's out of date. I mean, you know, one of the things that I'm really proud of is that Berkeley food movement has turned into a great American food revolution. And, you know, it's because of, you know, our collective and Alice Waters and that whole movement in Berkeley that, you know, we're really thinking about sustainable agriculture and, you know, what it means to be protectors of the earth, what it means to really think about growing foods with no pesticides, that the whole organic food movement has started, that we really think about what it means to, you know, try and feed people and not eat more than your share of protein. You know, really think about the earth as a whole place with diminishing resources. And I don't think any of that is outmoded. There's not one bit of it that I would change today.
You have a son who I believe is about 14, is that right?
He's 15, yes.
Okay. How has being a mother changed you as a cook? Because, let's face it, children's tastes and adults' tastes and foods are pretty different. And so you had to learn to cook for a child in addition to cooking for you and your husband.
I have to say the one thing that I feel as a mother is the most important thing, and it's why I ultimately stopped being a restaurant critic and took a job where I could be home cooking dinner every night, is that I think the most important thing you can do for your children is sit down to dinner together. We have breakfast and dinner every day with my family, and I don't think it matters what you put on the table or how you get that food on the table. I don't think it matters whether you cook it yourself or you order in, but I do think it's important to sit down and eat dinner with your children. And so I have tried to cook foods that Nick will like, but I think the notion that children have different tastes is sort of silly. You know, children in Vietnam eat different foods than children in France and children in the United States. And children eat what they are given. They aren't born with tastes. And I've never forced Nick to eat anything. You know, we'll cook things that he likes, but he started out as a kid who ate five white foods. And as a 15-year-old, he's an omnivore. He will eat anything. And I think it's partly because he just saw that we loved food.
Ruth Reichel, thank you so much for talking with us.
This has been a pleasure.
Ruth Reichel is the editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine and editor of the new Gourmet Cookbook.